This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's just for me too, and the rest of the guys in the dead. The bouquet of flowers is more interesting than one flower. If I can help this beautiful world of ours, this blue-green gem floating in space, flying in space, really, any way I can to help it be a better place, then that's what I want to do today.
The environmental and counterculture movements of the 60s have been inextricably linked since day one. The hippies decried war on materialism while promoting love, kindness, and care for the planet. And one of the through lines of this movement was music. This week on Sea Change Radio, we take some time to remember the life of the Grateful Dead's Bob Weir, who recently died at the age of 78. For many of us, across several generations, the Grateful Dead has been more than a band. It's a movement that's all about expanding your community and your mind. We dig into the archives to hear from Weir's longtime bandmate, Bill Kreutzmann, and listen to excerpts of two interviews we did with Bobby's late songwriting partner, John Perry Barlow.
My guest today on Sea Change Radio is the former drummer of the Grateful Dead, a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He lives in Kauai, Bill Kreutzmann. Bill, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
How you doing, Alex? Nice to be on the show.
Great to have you here. Let's dive into life on the road a little bit with the Grateful Dead. I was thinking of the Wall of Sound, where you decided to create one of the largest PA systems the world has ever seen, and that was chronicled pretty well in the Grateful Dead movie, in, I think 1974, 75, or no, I think it came out later because it took so long to produce, but that obviously was something that wouldn't be happening today, probably, when you consider sustainability and gas prices. But then I was thinking about it, that was right during the height of the gas crunch. What were some of the finances that went into that calculus?
Well, it was during that 73 gas crunch, that's for sure, but that didn't play a great problem for us. We didn't drive all that much. The Wall of Sound was so tremendous, it was unwieldy at best. We had a lot of rather angry crew guys having to set that thing up at each concert, and it was a great acoustic experiment, but it didn't resolve at the end. It didn't pay for itself in that way, in the sound way. So we never overdid that, so we didn't actually have to drive it that much.
So there's a scene which I just love in the Grateful Dead movie where you say, quote, "I call myself a four-sided schizophrenic because you have to have four separate ideas going and then a single thing here. It's more than just patting your head and rubbing your stomach because you're doing it with four things." When you get that down in music and drumming in particular, then you get so you can be dancing. And that is really fine because you sit back there and it feels just like you're dancing. You're playing and the groove is just right and the kicks aren't made, the accents and the rolls, they're not made. They're just into the flow, and that's the kind of music I like. So hearing you talk about dancing and drumming like dancing, what's in your life in Hawaii that most closely replicates that feeling?
This may surprise you, but it's gardening. I mean, I jam over here with wonderful musicians, but when I go out and I garden, I actually start moving around the garden like that. We have an organic garden here, of course, and it gives me such pleasure to be working with the earth and being able to do something right with the earth and be able to have the earth. It talks to me. And if you ask any gardener out there, they'll say, yeah, the plants talk to you, you know, and it really does. And this is the thing it says. The earth says, thank you for doing the right thing with me. Instead of blowing the top off me to get coal or destroying me by digging these thousand, you know, mile deep holes in the ocean and the ocean floor to get oil, you're planting something that's giving back to me, and then I can feed you. So that's my new line to the foresight of schizophrenic. That line, by the way, was before I really understood what schizophrenic meant. But it just means that you do four separate things when you're playing drums. Like I'd have my right hand would be playing with the lead, would be playing with Jerry. My foot would be playing with whatever Phil was playing. the backbeat would be me, and then the other hand and stuff would, or foot would be with Bobby. So I'd roll it around like that. That's what I meant by that four-sided schizophrenia. I always kind of regretted saying that a little bit, even though it sounds good when you read it.
I can just look in awe at somebody who can do four things. I have enough trouble just getting both my hands to move on piano or guitar. And so many musicians really have grown up injecting themselves into the Grateful Dead's music. I know when I was a teenager, I'd play along with Dead tapes and I'd figure out a tune or try to fit my guitar sound into a jam and think, hey, you know, I could be doing this. And it definitely inspired generations of people to go out and play. When you play along with recorded music, I assume you still do it to keep your chops up. What other bands could you see yourself playing in?
Yeah, the Grateful Dead was so all-consuming, you'd never even consider taking 6 months away from it. But the other bands I wanted to play with, I did play with them. I just didn't get to play with them physically. I did, like you suggested, I would put on earphones. That's actually how I do warm up today, is I sit in my little studio here. And one of my favorite bands right now to play to, let's get it more current, is Dumpster Funk, which is a New Orleans band. You know, they play some real hard groove stuff, some deep groove stuff with really cool accents and syncopations. And I love following along, making myself learn that stuff. You know, it's instead of copying an exact part, copy the way it flavors, copy the way it feels, and do it that way instead of playing note for note.
It must expand your musical horizons to be able to take a taste of this and a taste of that while your roots are Phil Lesh.
Well, my first musical roots are definitely like you're saying, but before the Grateful Dead started, when I was in even junior high school, I was playing with guys that were 20 years old because I was the young go-for-it drummer, right? I didn't know any better. My dad would drive me in a station wagon to gigs at YMCA, or I'd play at the Stanford University fraternity parties and stuff like that. I couldn't work enough, and so that as a kid, I was like that. But then once the Grateful Dead started, you couldn't leave it. It was just all there, you know? I was always just a little frustrated, and this is on me, that I played only in the Grateful Dead during that time period, those 30 years of Grateful Dead music. I had some other side bands, but nothing like I'm doing now. See, I didn't study in the formal sense. I didn't go to college to study music. I studied by, just like you suggested, I would listen to music and make my stuff sound like that, until it did sound like that. And that's part of patting your head and rubbing your stomach. That thing is that I would come across something I really liked, a musical idea, whatever band it was. And I'd make myself learn that part so it was so natural, I didn't have to think about it anymore. When I finally got it so natural that I wasn't having to put a mental process to it to make it work, it was just a feeling working, I would memorize that feeling. And that way I could learn the part the best. Instead of just having it superficially memorized, I would learn it down inside more.
And you juxtapose that with your musical brother, Mickey Hart, who came from a more traditional marching band tradition, correct?
Yeah, which I never understood. I used to always kid him about this. I say, come on, play that bass drum a little more, you know? And he said, well, I've been marching for all these years, and we only use our two hands.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and you're listening to our tribute to the late, great Bobby Weir.
Now back to my discussion with Grateful Dead drummer Bill Kreutzmann. Deadheads have a warm spot in their hearts for certain dates and places. And like, if I go up to a Deadhead and we, you know, I find out that he likes a Dead, I can mention Barton Hall 5877. I can say Fillmore East 42871, 21370. These are like the famous shows, and I assume that they all kind of meld together in your brain because you actually lived it and played it. But do you ever catch yourself in your garden sitting back and remembering a few of these dates and say, hey, I remember that 213 when that would have been 40 years ago since we played Alligator there or Darkstar?
I don't have that analytical type of memory, and the way I really remember shows is I remember the feeling from them, that they really felt good, or, you know, a lot of cool people came and the band played great. And I just have that good feeling when I'm out in the garden. I'm not really thinking about music particularly. I don't know. Maybe I just walk naturally in rhythm.
How do these memories get thrown back into your brain after living them so many years ago?
They're not literal memories. They're not like a reporter going to the gig and saying, okay, this happened, and that happened, right? The memories for me do run together, like you suggested, and it's more of a feeling that I get. I say, God, that gig was really cool. I feel good. That's what I remember. I don't remember any specifics about Jill meeting Jeff or this person meeting that person or somebody having a baby, you know.
Is this what you're talking about a little bit? You get these little feelings that like replicate what you felt in an era?
It's like, if I think back, this is a real straight heart example. I think back to the show Altamont. We didn't actually play, but we were standing on the stage when that horrible stuff happened. I get a bad taste almost, like, oh, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to tell you or anybody about the specifics of what I saw that day. I just put that in, oh, too bad that ever had to happen, you know?
Right.
The good shows are quite the opposite. You just have a good feeling in your heart, in your gut. That, oh, that was really fun. A lot of people had a great time, and you felt really good doing it. And that's how I remember shows. I remember Woodstock because we were getting slightly electrocuted by the scaffolding. It wasn't properly grounded. I remember Watkins Glen when we played to 600,000 people and flying in.
But the sound check of Watkins Glen is what people remember from that.
You're right. The sound check. Me and Jerry both agreed that we played better at the sound check than we did the gig, you know. But when we flew in the day of the gig, every place you looked was a person. I've never seen anything like that.
Can you differentiate your memories from when you were playing as a duo with Mickey on drums versus when you were back there solo, or is that kind of all meshed together?
No, actually, I remember more about playing with Mickey than I do when I was playing solo, to tell you the truth. He was influential to me. It was very important to me because he came in, like you said earlier, with rudiments, drumming rudiments, and he said, this would be really cool. You could play the drums, but if you learn this stuff, it'll really add on. You could compare it to going to graduate school. And he taught me the rudiments, and we practiced and all that. And it became part of my personality, and I started using these in my playing, and it helped immensely. And him and I have had some of the most amazing drum sessions and drums in space in the Grateful Dead than I can ever recall. They're so amazing that I think you'd have to be somebody like Einstein to remember them.
Well, we have some of them in our hearts as Deadheads. I think everyone has their own little favorites. And having that archive and having all the tapes, you were like the first open source business model in a lot of ways, which we're seeing now playing itself out on the internet. It allowed people to have their own experiences with it instead of it didn't have to just be what you projected.
That's exactly right. That's why we played music that you could have many feelings or many opinions about. You know, it wasn't clear cut, oh, this is good or bad. It's just for me too. And the rest of the guys in the Dead, the bouquet of flowers is more interesting than one flower. If I can help this beautiful world of ours, this blue-green gem floating in space, flying in space, really, any way I can to help it be a better place, then that's what I want to do today.
Bill Kreutzmann, you've brought a lot of joy to a lot of people with your music through the years, and it's been a delight having you on the show. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks. It's been a pleasure talking with you, my friend.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and you're listening to our tribute to Bob Weir, who recently passed away at the age of 78.
John Perry Barlow is my guest on Sea Change Radio. Welcome to Sea Change Radio, John Perry.
I'm glad to be here.
So for our listeners, tell us, who is John Perry Barlow?
Well, I've always been pretty much the same guy, though it would seem not on the surface of things. I've had a number of what would appear to be extremely different careers. I spent 20 years as a cattle rancher in Wyoming, during which time I was also writing songs for the Grateful Dead, and working as a semi-pro environmentalist, running the largest, actually the only really credible environmental group in Wyoming for a good chunk of that time. And I started the Electronic Frontier Foundation clear back in 1990 when I realized that everybody was going to come to cyberspace. And more recently, I have become involved in trying to come up with carbon negative and sustainable fuel sources, because I think that perhaps the most pressing problem facing the species at the moment is how we're going to deal with our rapidly increasing energy demands in a way that doesn't also dump a huge amount of more carbon into the atmosphere at a time when that is probably an unwise thing to do.
What do you see on the horizon in terms of energy and the environment?
I've been accused of being a futurist. I tend to think of myself as a presentist. I predict the present, which might sound like a fool's errand, except for the fact that most people are busy predicting the past. You know, when I look at the present, we have water problems on this planet that I think are going to be very shortly a central human concern. And our capacity for being in denial about this is really quite sublime. I mean, we have drawn down what had been an enormous storage in Lake Mead, for example, and in fact, the whole Colorado River drainage, using water that just basically wasn't there. I was flying out of Palm Springs several years ago and looking down at this very weird landscape that's been artificially created there, and sitting next to it, you know, an older white-haired guy, pink skin, yellow pants, golfer. And I said, "How many golf courses do you have down there?" And he said, "Oh my goodness, we're so proud of that. We have 109 golf courses," or some such figure, which is pretty prodigious. And I said, "Well, gosh, 109 golf courses. I mean, where's the water coming from for this?" And he said, "Oh, we got plenty of water. It's in the aquifer." And I said, "Well, they're pumping it out of the aquifer underneath the Palm Springs Desert." And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, aquifers generally are like ancient water storage. I mean, they're not getting recharged, most of them." And he said, "Well, no, I don't suppose this one is either, but we've got at least another 100 years of water in it." And he said 100 years like that was all the time the human race needed.
At least he needs.
Well, it certainly was way more than he needed. But, you know, and beyond his contemporary golfing needs, he didn't seem to care about it much. And
100 years is thrown around pretty cavalierly by a lot of people talking about resource depletion. You live in Wyoming, which is one of the largest deposits of coal in the planet.
Why, we've got 100 years of coal in Wyoming alone.
So nothing to worry about.
Not a thing to worry about. That's just crazy talk. And we just have to be much more thoughtful about how we go about being part of the natural ecology of planet Earth ourselves, since we are the dominant ecological force at this point in the life of the planet.
You say you're a presentist, and I thought of the lyric from Throwing Stones, where you say, "The future's here, we are it, we're on our own."
That's correct. And the future is here. As my friend Bill Gibson says, it's the future's here, it's just unevenly distributed.
Well, in the 70s, you were a little bit more of the conservative branch of the Grateful Dead family, so to speak. Were you raised with conservative values?
I was raised with I'm from Wyoming, you know.
That's Dick Cheney's home.
Well, and you know, I'll pay for this in hell, no doubt. But, I mean, I was one of Dick Cheney's campaign managers when he ran for Congress first time, you know, and was a Republican state official.
So does that come from your family?
I mean, I was raised in a political family, which was a very conservative Republican family.
Well, your songs reflect, you can see the evolution in your thinking and being more proactive with environmental issues. Which led which in terms of, did you decide as the Grateful Dead became more and more popular that this was a great soapbox for you to get your messages across? Or was it
I tried never to preach with my songs anyway.
But they became a little more explicit in terms of the messages.
It became a little more explicit in ways that, you know, actually embarrassed me slightly.
Like which ones?
Well, I wouldn't want to be specific, but I mean, I was trying to be more didactic than I think was a good idea. I mean, Bob Hunter and I realized sometime in the 70s that what seemed to be gathering itself naturally around the Grateful Dead was something that had many of the characteristics of a religion. And that made us uneasy. And then, you know, we thought about it some and then thought what really made us uneasy about religion was dogma, you know, and the capacity to have a belief system you could impose on somebody else. But Hunter and I thought, well, you know, the most dangerous part of religion is dogma or godma. And if there was going to be dogma in the mysterious religion of the Deadheads, it was going to come most likely from our songs. So we were very scrupulous about not giving them the opportunity to form anything out of those songs, you know, and not being preachy and not having the substrate of a belief system that they could then develop that had some sort of authoritative point of reference.
Picture a bright blue ball just spinning free, dizzy with eternity, painted with the skin of sky, brushing some clouds of sea, going home for you and me. A peaceful place, or so it looks from space. A closer look reveals the human race. Full of hope, full of grace is the human face. Afraid, we're there on the waste. Faith and fear down here, we can't forget. As God name just always awake, always around. Seeing ashes, ashes all fall down.
Ashes, ashes all fall down.
Now watch as the fear revolves and the nighttime falls. Come once with the stars, the celestial bar.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and you're listening to our tribute to the late, great Bobby Weir.
Our belief was all along, you know, I mean, there was a big schism in the counterculture as it developed in the 60s between the politicos and the acid heads, you know, the radicals over in Berkeley and the peace and love camp over in the Haight. And they didn't actually get along with each other very well at all. One of them completely lacked a sense of humor, for one thing, and they were authoritarian, and they, you know, they were already acting like the new boss, even though they weren't.
And there's schisms within the Grateful Dead, I'm sure the band, and also the Deadheads in terms of whether, as the band became more popular in, you know, intellectual property rights and allowed taping versus, you know, playing bigger and bigger venues with higher prices. And
yeah. You know, well, I mean, money f***s everything up. That's the demonic bargain that you make with the devil when you go out and make a lot of money. You're gonna lose a lot of your original purpose. But anyway, so I was never particularly didactic with my songwriting, and I had a growing set of beliefs about nature that were important to me. And, you know, and also, in a spiritual sense, an awareness that everything is alive. To me, it is. And that there is something holy about life. It's such a freakish development in the universe. It has this astonishing capacity to fly directly in the face of entropy.
And somehow that becomes preachy to some people, but it's reality.
It's demonstrable. If you start saying things about what life wants, besides more, you know, I mean, the motto of life, as far as I can tell, is more.
Right, you say in We Can Run,
We Can Run, but we can't hide, yeah.
Well, you say we got everyone believing that more is more.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it isn't. If everything is thinking more and more and more and more and more, you know, it's a damn good thing that you know, in the complex interaction of all living things, there are other versions of more that your more is going to run up against, you know, and then there's a balance struck. And that's why life works with these very simple algorithms operating, is because they run into each other and they balance out.
as a musician now, you have to make your money on touring and merchandise and things like that.
Well, that was always the case because the record companies were making all the money on the records. That was, it was never any different, except that it's now possible, I think, to create a devoted fan base that isn't very big, that is perfectly capable of supporting you. In the past, because there was, because the record companies were eating most of it for their own, you know, driving around Bel Air in their Porsche needs, we weren't making any money, but we didn't care because we weren't spending any, you know. Hell, I mean, there were nights when the Grateful Dead was like the Special Olympics of rock and roll. I mean, it, you know, there were plenty of times they weren't very good either. But by virtue of being completely liberal with our so-called intellectual property, we had created this, we basically invented viral marketing. And we'd created this rabidly devoted following that really was there pretty early and was capable of supporting us all along.
I read some Harvard Business study on the Grateful Dead and viral marketing. So you guys were like the first social media in a lot of ways.
I later started writing about this in the early 90s, you know, basically taking what I felt like we had learned by, you know, and demonstrated by becoming as affluent as we were. By giving our stuff away. And that had been key to that affluence, was the fact that we had just let people tape the concerts. And at the time, you know, at the time that decision was made, nobody realized that it was going to be an economically smart thing to do. In fact, the assumption was that it wasn't, but that we actually didn't care that much about money and we weren't making any anyway, so why get terribly concerned about it?
Now here's an excerpt from our last conversation with John Perry Barlow, not long before his passing. Changing the subject a little bit, John Perry, you've been ill for quite some time. You picked a unfortunate year to get sick with the Grateful Dead's reunion and the Fare Thee Well tours. What did that feel like, missing out on
all
that?
It was really awful. I mean, in fact, at one point, we had worked up a way for me to go to one of the concerts in San Carlos. Even my back surgeon was going to go with me. I had a couple of nurses. They had a skybox reserved for my use. They had an ambulette that they were paying for. And some official, I don't know, somewhere in the upper reaches of the management at UCSF just nixed it. It was like being told I couldn't go to the funeral of my mother. It was really tough.
Really appreciate you being our guest on Sea Change Radio. John Perry Barlow, thanks for being with me on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by The Grateful Dead.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.